The next case for oral argument this morning is 25-1691, U.S. v. Pena. Morning, Mr. Hillis.
Good morning, Judge St. Eve, Judge Maldonado, Judge Sykes. My name is Daniel Hillis. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office. I represent Mr. Pena on this appeal. There are four issues. The fourth is uncontested by the government. That's the condition of supervised release about the risk to third parties, so I don't plan to spend any time on it. I'm going to focus my attention instead to start.
Before you do, please, do you agree that the proper remedy for that is to remand to the district court to address it?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
And on the due process issue, we'd like a reversal. We'd like to send this case back and start with the proper procedural protections to ensure that my client has the protections that are granted to him by the Constitution as well as 32.1 and the related case law. So with regard to the due process, my client was given materials from the probation office that were relied upon by the district court, and he received those beginning, I think, on April 9th. He received another series of police reports or another police report on April 10th. The revocation hearing was April 16th, so he had very few days for purposes of notice to receive the materials that were ultimately relied upon by the district court. The government says you do not get due process. We disagree. The Constitution says that you get it.
And so but he was very clear through his lawyer that he didn't want more time. He was ready to go forward with this. So I think the notice question and your argument that he didn't have enough time to review all of this is hard to make given that the court said you need more time and he wanted to go.
Grade C violations. He was ready to go on the grade C's, not the grade B's. And so the police reports are related to the grade B violations, and the parties agree that that was unproven conduct. And so I would have to respectfully disagree, Your Honor, that he says that he's ready to go.
But
go on what?
The comments the court made with respect to the police report didn't deal with the underlying criminal activity that took place in the grade B violations. The court referenced the scuffle and the fact that he fell through the ceiling in connection with her comment that she was worried about his behavior and that he was a danger to the community, and the fact that he's not reporting to his probation officer, he's left the jurisdiction. Those grade C violations all raised her concerns that in his criminal history that he was a danger to the community.
I don't think they can narrow it like that. So the allegation was that he was in the Dunkin' Donuts and he was in the other place, the antique store, as a result of a burglary. So
but
to say that it's a-
The court didn't say anything about the burglary. The focus from the police report was her comment about, I'm worried somebody's gonna get hurt here. And in fact, what just happened with you falling through the ceiling of the bathroom onto the officer who got hurt. He says, oh yeah, I got hurt. And she said, well, that's my point.
Sure, but again, you can't take it out of the context that it was offered. There's a police report summarizing what was
alleged
burglary.
I'm paraphrasing from the transcript. That's the context it was offered in.
No, the police officer's statement, I'm trying to focus my attention there, Judge, was about suspected burglary.
I'm focusing on the court's use of what was in the police report, because I don't think you could say she used the whole thing. I mean, what she refers to from the police report is, again, the scuffle in the bathroom when she's talking about, given these grade C violations in his criminal history, I'm worried somebody's going to get hurt.
Your Honor, I have to respectfully disagree. The police report, you can't say that the judge didn't rely on the context of where the conduct occurred and how inherently dangerous burglaries are.
There's nothing in what she said in the court that refers, when she's talking about the sentence, that refers to the underlying robbery there. It's all focused on the, somebody's going to get hurt.
Right, and I think burglaries are inherently dangerous. That's been the law, and I don't think there's anything to the counter point, Judge, that the judge cabined her remarks to say, I'm not considering it as if a burglary happened here. I'm just talking about your dangerousness. And I'd put in further context, the concerns were that he's been engaged in burglaries in the past and now, or in criminal conduct related to theft of property, and he's continuing to do it in the particular context would matter, I think, to any judge. But I'll move on. So In terms of Rule 32.1 errors, the materials are nevertheless submissions by an adverse party, the police officers, and so 32.1b2c requires that the individual who was at the defense table be entitled to cross-examine, question the officers about the reports. That didn't happen. And it was also assumed that the reports were reliable, and I think both of those things are contrary to the law, especially as this court's Jordan opinion discusses the importance of honoring Rule 32.1b2c and ensuring that judges go through the necessary steps of ensuring that an individual has the opportunity
to cross. So, Mr. Hillis, if we think that the court only relied on the fact that the police officer got hurt and your client's statement that he got hurt too in the incident, do these arguments about cross-examination still apply? Or would you agree that if it is that narrow, that those don't apply?
No. The reports trigger the right, like that would the due process in the 32.1. We don't get to say now, because we think that maybe the judge was talking about something else or being very specific and narrow. The reports are the evidence that the government's used, or rather the probation office used and attached to the reports. So that triggers the rights.
And when you said, when you started out that you're asking us to reverse, you're just focusing on the sentence here, not the revocation.
Correct? Yes. Well, there's a component of the breach that could cause us to worry about the entirety of this, but we are focused.
Well, given your client's admissions to the grade C violations, I think you'd have a hard time asking for reversal of the revocation.
Sure. I think that we could have, but our focus is just to get the benefit of the bargain, Judge. And so when the government goes in with an agreed sentence for 14 months, we expect, in the language Ms. Chavez, for the government to turn square corners. And if the government is going to do things like say to the judge, 14 months, but you can go higher. I mean, the purpose of alerting the judge the ability to go higher is to induce the judge to go higher and give a sentence.
But the judge already knows that, right?
So why say it?
Well, you know, she's stating the obvious, a statement of the law. So you think that that is the breach, that you could go higher?
Two.
Okay.
Two. So that's not unimportant. And the Diaz-Jimenez case talks about telling judges how we wouldn't be disappointed prosecutors if you give higher sentences than we ask for. Lip service, right? Turning square corners, scrupulously honoring agreements, right?
The government's obligation. How is that any different than a plea agreement, where there's an agreed sentence that government agrees I'm going to jointly recommend X amount, but the plea agreement has a provision in it that says the court could go higher? How is that any different?
Because the judge doing it on the judge's own versus at the slight invitation of a prosecutor who, if I may further answer Judge Maldonado's question, the more glaring part of the breach, in our opinion. We don't think that the first part's unimportant, but the second part, where you're telling the judge, please consider the probation officer's presentation for a 24-month sentence, even though we've just agreed to 14, is definitely, in our view, working around the ends. And so if you're going to make an agreement,
where do we draw that line, though? Because that's not exactly what she said. I think she said something to the extent of, I understand why probation is recommending 24 months because he's over 40 and he's been at this for a long time. So where do we draw that line? Because she's expressing understanding of probation's position, but she's still saying, I recommend 14 months.
Sure. Who's the captain of the ship in that circumstance? I would say it's the prosecutor. If the prosecutor says, we've agreed to 14 months, and we know sometimes that a victim may want a higher sentence or a police officer may want a higher sentence, we nevertheless leave it to the government to make the decisions about what is the appropriate sentence. And there's a reason for that, but because it falls on the exercise of their discretion and judgment. But also, we don't allow the victims and the police officers to come in and do an end run. And if the government isn't comfortable with this, there's a very, very easy way around all this so it doesn't create any problems. Don't reach agreements. Don't enter into them, right? Then we don't have this problem. Then probation can stand up and say whatever it wants, and if we make an argument about surrogate prosecution, at least it's not with the blessing of the government, who just said, we agree to 14 months, but now we'd like you to entertain this presentation by the probation office for 24 months. That doesn't sound like my client's getting the benefit of the bargain.
But the government went on to say, essentially to tell the court, I understand the probation office is asking or recommending more, but we have an agreement for 14 months, and I think that is appropriate for the following reasons. you've got that but in there from the government.
Judge, there can be lots of buts, but there should also be moments where prosecutors say, we have made an agreement, Judge. We don't need to hear from the probation office. We are doing our duty. The probation officer has already done its duty. So we don't allow police officers to say,
So you're saying that the probation officer wouldn't have the right to give her opinion at that point or to give her recommendation? That's part of the sentencing process.
I think it's an end run around the agreement, Judge. When you're going to bless the probation officer's efforts as the prosecutor in the
revocation. I think it's the blessing part that I take controversy with.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I don't recall anywhere in the transcript where the government opposed it and said, based on the agreement, which we are going to scrupulously honor here,
Judge. Well, the government did oppose it because the government said, but we recommend 14 months and here's why.
The government explicitly asked that the judge be allowed to consider what the probation officer's presentation was. There's no two ways about that from the transcript, because the defense attorney stood, or sat, whichever, but said that this is in violation. This is surrogate prosecution. And so that is contrary to Smith and any of the good language from Peterson for us on that. Apart from the Rule 32.1 issues, and we think that it's clearly the case that when the judge relies on those, ultimately at appendix pages 41 through 44 to impose sentence, we know that the dangerousness, et cetera, that is referred to, or the conduct about interactions with the police officers, however they occurred, that is influencing the sentencing decision. And so that is clearly connected. But the Asteris error, to turn briefly to that, the district court is not allowed to consider the seriousness of the offense. And so this is Rule 3553A2A that allows a judge to consider that at the time of the criminal sentencing, but
the prohibition is against considering the seriousness of the underlying offense, not the violations conduct. And wasn't the judge referring to the violations conduct?
I think it's murky from the Supreme Court's decision about that, Judge, but I think the judge considered both.
Well, so that's how the statute reads, I think.
As I recall the opinion.
Right, because it's referring back to the factors in 3553A, which are the sentencing factors at the original sentencing. So it has to be referring to the original underlying offense rather than the violations conduct.
Accepting that most limited reading of it, we would still have the judge saying your history of dangerousness is basically was referred to the broad the criminal conduct that talks about his dangerousness in the prior robberies. I think that the judge is throwing her arms around not just the instant conduct, but his history, which would bring in the 3553A2A prohibition.
But doesn't that also go to deterrence?
So if it goes to both, I would say we're still covered.
The court made very clear here, the court was considering it for deterrence. And the Supreme Court said that was appropriate in Astera.
The Supreme Court, though, has also said in Astera that you're not allowed to consider the seriousness of it. Seriousness and dangerousness are synonyms, and I don't know that we can say without effectively undermining, as the Seventh Circuit's view of Astera, what Astera holds, that we would allow the judges to start consider dangerousness, seriousness, et cetera, and say that's okay because we have a slightly different read than what the express languages out of Asteris. With that, I reserve the balance of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. Ms. Mecklenburg, good morning.
May it please the court, Sherry Mecklenburg on behalf of the United States. It's the district court did not err in revoking defendant's supervised release, and it sounded like the appellant is no longer arguing that there was any error in the actual revocation, given that the defendant admitted violations 2 through 5, and that is what the district court based the revocation on. So I will move on to the other issues, starting with whether the government adhered to the agreement that the government made to recommend 14 months. And the court correctly recognizes that the government did adhere to that in terms of by talking about the aggravating factors that probation based their recommendation on, What the government is signaling to the court is, I've considered all of those, the government has considered those aggravating factors, and here's why 14 months is still appropriate. If the government ignores all those aggravating factors and just says 14 months, it is not persuasive to the court. So that is not a breach of the government's agreement, nor is it a breach of the government's agreement to say that probation had the right to make a recommendation. In fact, the defense attorney also said that probation had the right to make a recommendation. So the government never violated its agreement. And also by telling the court that they could go higher, the court itself knew that and in fact told the defendant in the colloquy, you understand that I can go higher and you cannot back out of your admissions once I go higher. So that's not what caused the court to go higher. The court certainly knew that. The district court did not err in deciding to sentence the defendant to 24 months for his violations of supervised release. First, the court did not violate 32.1 at sentencing regarding the notice of the police reports. As the court recognized, this issue was waived by the defendant. The district court listed all of the documents and evidence that it had at the beginning of the hearing, and then asked affirmatively if the defense needed more time. The defense said that the defendant conferred with his counsel, and then they came back and said that they did not want more time. And all through the hearing, the district court invited the defendant to take more time at different points of the hearing, and the defendant insisted that he wanted to proceed that day. And even in his colloquy, he talked about why he was in a hurry to get this done.
That would go to the notice issue.
Yes.
What about the court's reference to the police report that involved a violation that the defendant had not admitted to, and the reference to the bathroom scuffle, I'll call it, between the defendant and a police officer, where both got hurt? Why isn't that problematic, given that the defendant didn't admit to that violation?
Because, Your Honor, the district court had the right to consider the police report as reliable hearsay at sentencing and found that police report was reliable. Let me back up. The prosecutor and defense counsel agreed, both told the court that they could not prove that the court could not use unproven conduct. And in fact, the defense counsel started that discussion with a reference to the underlying thefts the state charges. The court never found that the defendant had committed theft. The grade B violations, the court never found the grade B violations. And you'll see, I believe it's page 28 of the transcript, where the court said, I cannot make any findings as to those violations because the government has chosen not to prove them. Then when we got to sentencing, the court did, and on page 28, the court did also note, however, that's different than what I can consider at sentencing. And then at sentencing, when we got to sentencing, the court considered the police report as reliable hearsay. This court has found that police reports can be reliable. The court used it not for the underlying burglary or theft, but for that narrow example of how the defendant presents danger to himself, to law enforcement, and to the public. And the court found that it was reliable. It was not unreasonable to find that that was a reliable report. That report was a firsthand account of what the officers witnessed of the injury. They were on the scene, as opposed to, for instance, maybe someone else telling them, reporting the thefts that they weren't on the scene for. Those were detailed accounts. And the defendant corroborated those facts by his spontaneous outburst that he was the one hurt in that incident because he fell down and had to go to the hospital. So he didn't say that didn't happen. So under those circumstances, it was certainly reasonable for the court's narrow reliance on the police report as an example of how the defendant presents a danger to the community. As far as I heard the appellant raise the issue of the cross-examination of the police officers. Certainly, the defense counsel could have asked for time and subpoenaed the police officers or asked for the government and probation to work to bring them in. The defense decided not to, the defense decided to forego that. Lastly, the court properly applied the section 3553A factors. Esteros does prohibit a court from applying the punitive factors of section 3553A2A. But the court and the government acknowledges that in a case like this, Esteros says that where there's no objection, the review is for plain error. The government acknowledges that the Seventh Circuit has at times said that, has suggested that its precedent does not require an objection. But under any standard, the court does not need to decide this issue because this, the district court repeatedly relied on section 3553A2C, the need to protect the public, and also on the deterrence factor of 3553A2B. The court also mentioned her concern of under 3553A2D that the defendant had been out of touch for 15 months, and she was concerned about whether the defendant, about the fact that the defendant had obviously not gotten any correctional treatment. But the court approached the sentence from the concern of public safety, which is permissible under Esteros. The court talked about the defendant's long history of, I believe it was 20 theft-related convictions and 17 theft-related arrests. And the court talked about how that was a pattern that she was seeing. The court wasn't talking about the underlying conviction in West, in the Western District of Pennsylvania, which was conspiracy to transport stolen goods. The court was talking about the overall record and talked about how it started when the defendant was 18 and it went well into the defendant's 30s. And that this is the kind of pattern that creates a danger to the public, and that the West Chicago police incident was just an example of the danger to the public. The court never cited any punitive factors under section 3553A2A. The court never talked about the seriousness of the 2021 conviction. The court never talked about the need to promote respect for the law or the need to provide just punishment. If you have no further questions, then for the reasons stated, the government requests that this court affirm the revocation of supervised release and the sentence imposed by the district court with a limited remand to consider the application of special condition number 13 of the supervised release conditions.
Thank you, Ms. Mecklenburg.
Thank you.
Mr. Hillis.
To begin, it's not the defense burden to subpoena government witnesses who can come in and talk about police reports that they authored. The government has its burden, and it should have brought in the officers if it was going to rely on the reports. It didn't. Police reports are not per se reliable. Jordan says this, cites Downey versus Clincar. That's a longstanding principle. The court here made no findings about why the reports were reliable. It presumed that they were. That's a mistake. The officer's unavailability was never demonstrated in the district court. And as far as detailed police reports go, they are not in a special category because Jordan says detailed police reports didn't save the day in that case either. So details, corroboration, things like that are all things to be considered, but they weren't enough in Jordan. They're not enough here. Jordan, of course, resulted in a remand. And lastly, the government's recitation about the history of my client's conduct in the past and how it warrants the sentence in the view of the judge sounds very much to my ears, the judge talking about the seriousness of the conduct in the past to justify the 24-month sentence presently. With that, I would just add that we have never contested the revocation, and furthermore, that waiver, to the extent that there's any waiver here, must be construed liberally in favor of the defense. And so my client was waiving the right to contest any grade C violations when he admitted to them. He had never waived the right to have the protections for any grade B violations, and so that's an important thing to note. With that, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hillis. The court will take the case under advisement.